It is Tuesday, September 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, European ministers approve a plan for individual countries to accept 120,000 refugees. We speak with a representative of a human rights organization.
They need to realize that this is an absolute necessity. This crisis, as they call it, will not go away.
Russia builds up its military in Syria. Pope Francis arrives in Washington later today, and we hear about the final season of the British hit television show Downton Abbey. It's all ahead. European Union ministers Tuesday approved a quota plan to distribute 120,000 migrants throughout the 28-nation bloc. The meeting came after the European Parliament approved the plan last week, but the Czech Republic, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia cast votes in dissent. On Monday, Hungary's parliament authorized its army to use non-lethal force against migrants who try to enter the country illegally. I spoke with Barbara Csernozsu-Akva, Hungary researcher at Amnesty International in London. At the moment, your organization has been critical of the Hungarian government because recently, you know, Hungary has employed military to try to secure its borders. How do you think Hungary could improve the situation as the migrants continue to arrive?
Hungary needs to start respecting international law and also EU law in the first place. The response so far that we have observed so far has been one of militarization and enforcement of the borders, but it doesn't really focus on the fact that it has also obligations to protect people who are escaping wars, conflicts, and situations where their lives are at risk. So far, what we have seen is that Hungary has sealed off the border with Serbia and introduced legislation that criminalizes entry through the border. The Hungarian authorities are saying that people should be entering legally through the border checkpoints, but we've been monitoring the situation in these checkpoints, and in general, people completely lack information that it's actually possible and also lack information about the procedure at these border crossing, so-called transit zones. The ones that we spoke to and the decisions that we have seen have been rejected on the basis that these people entered Hungary through Serbia, and Hungary considers Serbia a safe third country. So anybody who enters this way is deemed ineligible for international protection in Hungary. From our perspective, based on research carried out recently, Serbia is not a safe third country. It doesn't have efficient asylum system. It doesn't have facilities to house thousands of refugees. And this politics of keeping refugees out on the Serbian side is therefore highly irresponsible, especially as the colder months are approaching and these people might be simply left out sleeping rough and without adequate facilities available to them.
As the EU ministers are meeting, this crisis is unfolding. Do you think that there will be a way that they can put together a sort of coherent plan to deal with the influx of people?
They need to realize that this is an absolute necessity. This crisis, as they call it, will not go away. People keep entering Europe or the territory of the EU and are attempting to enter. And there is simply no way how this is going to be resolved by enforcing the borders and not thinking in terms of ensuring access to which these people are actually entitled to under international human rights law and ensuring that there is adequate procedure for those that need protection and that will be ensured access to reception facilities, etc., etc. But so far, there has been quite a bit of lack of political will to radically reconsider the common asylum policies of the EU and to also show a greater level of solidarity with the member states that are on the front line of the EU. But then also, we are very critical towards the member states that are actually on the front line, such as Hungary, Bulgaria, or Greece, which have done very little to improve the situation in there. And Hungary is just a very recent example how the policies in general are really trying to keep people out rather than ensuring that there will be adequate level of protection.
Okay, well, I thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
That is Barbara Csernozsu-Akva, Hungary researcher at Amnesty International in London. Well, the European Union has been sharing news of its decision to relocate refugees on social media. Michael Lippin is here to tell us more about that. Michael, what have you seen?
Hi, Sarah. Well, I saw that the European Commission tweeted about the decision of its home ministers on its Twitter account, which is at EU_Commission. That tweet linked to a statement explaining the move by today's special meeting of EU Home Affairs ministers. The statement says that the 28-nation EU is now in a position to relocate a total of 160,000 people that it says are in clear need of international protection in the coming 2 years. It says the Commission and EU agencies will organize together with member states the necessary coordination to implement the mechanism on the ground. Now, the details of that coordination have yet to be released, and I think it's going to be interesting to see whether obstacles will arise because of the opposition of nations like Hungary to the idea of relocating the refugees and the migrants.
Well, Michael, apparently a variety of EU officials have also been tweeting about the relocation decision. Who are these officials?
Well, one of them is Margaritis Schinas. He is the chief EU Commission spokesperson, and his handle is at Marg Schinas. He tweeted a note saying that the EU Commission's defense of its community method led to today's breakthrough agreement. Now, the term community method describes a particular decision-making procedure that gives roles to the different EU institutions. Another tweet that I found comes from the EU's Commissioner for Migration, Home Affairs, and Citizenship. His name is Dimitris Avramopoulos, and his handle is at Avramopoulos. Earlier today, he said that the Commission is ready to help Serbia, one of the states where refugees and migrants have been gathering to try to enter the EU. Avramopoulos also tweeted that we need common solutions for common challenges. Well, you can follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. If you want to reach me on Twitter, you can find me at Michael_Lippin. Sarah?
Thank you, Michael. There are indications that Russia's military buildup in Syria is continuing. I'm joined now by VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, what kind of evidence is there as to the extent of Russia's military expansion within Syria?
Well, the earliest indications have been coming from what's called open source reporting. With the proliferation of the internet and social media sites, there's a lot of material that's been going up on YouTube, on other sites, some satellite images that are commercially available that have been accessed by several people that are beginning to show the extent of the Russian buildup. And that's in addition to what U.S. military and intelligence personnel are seeing through the various means they have of tracking what's going on. And so far, what's been seen is a consistent and steady measured buildup in an area of along the coast that's still controlled by Assad's forces. There's a international airport there, and there's also an airbase there in a town called Latakia. And about twice a day, the Russians have been landing, according to these sources and to U.S. military and intelligence officials, about two big cargo planes, AN-124 Condors, with lots of equipment. They've also been sending ships to a nearby port, Tartus, and they've been supplying other equipment there. Now, part of what's been going on has been standard. The Russians have been doing this all along, supporting the regime of President Bashar al-Assad, which has been one of their longtime allies. And as one intelligence official said, Syria has been their toehold in the Middle East. So there's been consistent report. But over the last several weeks, it's ramped up. And they've brought in a modular housing units that can house up to 2,000 troops as of right now. The U.S. officials say it appears they have about 500 naval infantrymen, what would be considered like U.S. Marines, already stationed at that airbase. And in addition, they've upped the number of combat aircraft there to about 28 combat aircraft overall, talking about fighter jets, attack jets, fighter bombers that can provide both offensive capabilities air-to-air, also air-to-ground support, either in a defensive or an offensive manner for both the Russian troops and potentially the forces loyal to President Assad. In addition to that, the Russians have brought in military helicopters, both attack helicopters and transport helicopters that could be used to ferry troops to various missions, even in search and rescue. One U.S. official said it could also potentially be used for some humanitarian relief efforts, although that's not consistent with the other evidence that's coming through. And they also have some surface-to-air missiles. They first brought in a control tower, and from the satellite images that are coming in, it looks like they're expanding their presence at this airbase. And again, the number of shipments has been consistent at about 2 a day by plane. There's also the shipments coming in by boat. So it's a steady, measured buildup. And as one U.S. official told me, it's a significant buildup, and this is a long-term deal.
Have the Russians at all publicly acknowledged any of this?
The Russians have talked about it publicly. Sergei Lavrov, some other, the foreign minister, some other Russian officials have talked about their desire to make good on commitments they already had with Syria. And that's why some of this stuff has been going in. They've also been talking very publicly for weeks about wanting to do more to combat the Islamic State, ISIS, or ISIL, as the terror group is known, and had made some comments publicly and also privately asking to talk to the United States about perhaps becoming a bigger part of the effort to combat the Islamic State. Remember, the U.S. is leading a coalition right now that of about 60 countries that's been launching airstrikes against the Islamic State, both in Iraq and in Syria. The U.S. officials tend to question the sincerity of the Russian desire to combat the Islamic State, as they could already have done it, though they've been leaving open the door for Russia to take a greater role. As U.S. officials say, Russia does have assets that would be useful in that fight. The big concern, though, in terms of the Russian military buildup in the short term is what military officials called deconfliction. If the Russians start flying these planes, and there's some anecdotal evidence that they may be, there's some open source material that's not been confirmed by U.S. intelligence officials or U.S. military officials that Russian planes have been in the sky. There's been reporting by some news organizations talking to rebel groups in Syria that say they've seen an increase in the capabilities of the forces loyal to President Assad. So if the Russians start doing more, there's a chance that Russian planes, that Syrian Air Force planes, and that U.S. and coalition planes could end up operating in the same area. Within the past week, there were reports that the Syrian Air Force, what's left of it, conducted some strikes against the Islamic State stronghold in Raqqa, and that's an area that's been targeted by the U.S. and the coalition. So part of the concern is making sure that these forces, the Russian forces, the U.S. and coalition forces, don't accidentally engage each other. And the U.S. finally has started talking to the Russians about this. Within the past week, the U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter had his very first conversation with his Russian counterpart. Those talks have been called off until now by the Pentagon because of Russia's actions in Crimea and Ukraine.
All right, VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Thanks very much.
Anytime.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study finds that 3.3 million people from around the world die prematurely every year from the effects of air pollution. German researchers say that number could double to 6.6 million a year by 2050 if air pollutants are allowed to increase at the present rate. The researchers say that about 75% of those premature deaths are due to strokes or heart attacks. The study, led by scientists at Germany's Max Planck Institute for Chemistry, also finds that 75% of the air pollution-related early deaths occur in Asia, mostly in China and India. Early deaths related to air pollution could also rise at a moderate rate in Europe and the United States, especially in the big cities in those regions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the cast and crew of Downton Abbey shoots the show's final season. Pope Francis will be arriving in the United States Tuesday after celebrating a third and final Mass in Cuba. I'm joined now by VOA's religion correspondent, Jerome Sokolowski. So, Jerome, there's a lot of excitement here in Washington as the pontiff will be arriving. What are some of the activities he will be involved in when he gets here?
Well, here in Washington, he'll be meeting President Obama. He'll actually meet the president and vice president at the airport. He'll go to the White House. He will canonize a Spanish missionary who established missions out in California. He'll do that here in Washington. And he will address Congress as well in Washington. And then he goes on, of course, there's much more in this trip in New York and Philadelphia as well.
Yes, and actually after he leaves D.C., is he then in New York City?
Then he goes to New York City. The main event there is his address at the U.N. General Assembly, and it seems President Obama will be there as well. He'll be at Madison Square Garden and make a trip across Central Park. The biggest part of the trip, though, I mean, you might already be out of breath by hearing all of this, but will be his appearance in Philadelphia in the weekend. He won't meet superpower leaders there, but the three biggest events of this trip will be in Philadelphia. He'll have a huge mass in the middle of the city. He'll speak at Independence Hall, and he will also make an appearance at a big world meeting of families that's expecting around 1 million people.
And this, I believe, is his first visit to the United States.
This is his first visit to the United States as Pope and also as a person. He's never come here before. And he has, I think there is some significance to that he doesn't see, or at least until now, he hasn't seen the U.S. as really being the center of the world. To him, the important parts of the world are the peripheries, people in poorer countries, people who are normally neglected. And that's been the emphasis of this papacy so far.
All right. Thanks very much. That's VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski.
Thank you, Sarah.
This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. One of television's biggest hits is Downton Abbey. The British series is now in its sixth and final season. Downton Abbey is viewed by millions around the world, so fans are eagerly awaiting the conclusion. Here's International Edition's David Byrd with a look at the world of Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey is truly a worldwide phenomenon. The drama about the fictional Crawley family is shown in more than 100 countries. ITV, which commissioned the show, says an average of 11 million viewers watch the series in Britain alone. In the United States, last season's finale was seen by more than 25 million people. But now, the final season has come, and cast members have mixed emotions about it. Actor Hugh Bonneville, who plays family patriarch Robert Crawley, the 7th Earl of Grantham, says the time feels right for the show to close.
Originally it was going to be 5, and then I went and had a chat with Julian, and I wanted to see the whites of his eyes about whether he wanted to do a 6th, and he said, and he explained why he wanted to do a 6th.
The show began with the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 and has followed the Crawley family through 13 years of love and tragedy. The sixth season will carry the storyline to the edge of the Great Depression. Elizabeth McGovern plays Cora, Countess of Grantham. She says that the storyline follows the history of large houses in England at the time.
They're not able to continue the life as they know it much beyond that, the decade of the 20s. So that sort of works well for the story. The lifestyle is ending as our series is ending.
The show is filmed at Highclere Castle in Newbury, West Berkshire, currently the home of the Earl and Countess of Carnarvon. The castle has provided fans with stunning views of its interiors, including the main staircase, the dining room, the drawing room, and the library. Downton Abbey has also been a boon for the castle, with tours selling out months in advance. The success of the series, including 59 Emmy nominations and 11 wins, surprised writer Julian Fellowes, who thought that it was aimed mainly at a British audience.
And then it opened in America and became a very big hit there, and then China and Asia and, you know, Africa, and all of these whole continents took to the show. And I can't really explain why particularly, but I'm terribly pleased they did.
While many of the family scenes are filmed in the castle, the downstairs scenes involving the servants are done in a studio because the real kitchens and servant areas are not suitable. Jim Carter, who plays the strict butler, Mr. Carson, says the final servant's scene turned out to be the final scene of the final episode, which made for an emotional wrap-up.
So we were in the servants' hall, all the gang, candle lit. Quite a sort of a muted sort of scene, not a big dramatic scene, quite low-key. And then they said, cut, and that's goodbye to all the servants. And then I sort of thought, oh, we should thank all the wonderful crew there. And I started to say a few words on behalf of everybody. Before I knew it, oh my God, I was a mess. And then I looked around and all the crews were like this, all the blokes all crying. And I thought, yeah, it was a soggy mess.
Very sad.
Michelle Dockery, Lady Mary Crawley to fans of the show, says though it's sad to leave her cast members, in the end, Downton Abbey is just a television show.
It's still a drama, and there has to be some sense of, you know, it's make-believe, it's not real. So I think it's important not to take it too seriously.
Show producer Gareth Neame says that there's nothing to stop someone from making a newer version of the Crawley saga, but for now he says that cameras are moving away from the Crawleys. Downton Abbey began its final season in Britain September 20th, American fans will have to wait to see it on PBS's Masterpiece beginning in January. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
The end of an era for Downton Abbey fans. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fundamedios, an Ecuadorian free speech group founded in 2006, may soon have to close its doors. The Ecuadorian government announced on September 8th its decision to initiate legal steps intended to dissolve Fundamedios. The United States, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, is very concerned about the increasing restrictions on freedom of expression and freedom of association in Ecuador. Under President Rafael Correa, verbal and legal attacks against the media and civil society have intensified. According to the latest State Department Human Rights Report, new regulatory bodies established under the law have issued a series of sanctions, fines, and forced corrections and retractions, primarily against independent media. Fundamedios, which started the year before Ecuador's current president Correa took office, defends journalists and news outlets that have been targeted by the government for lawsuits and fines. Fundamedios has also been highly critical of a restrictive new communications law that went into effect in 2013. Many rights groups, said spokesperson Kirby, have spoken out against the Ecuadorian government's latest action against Fundamedios. Human Rights Watch said in a statement, the Correa administration wants to punish an organization for tweeting articles with news and opinions it doesn't like. This is an egregious abuse of power and a clear example of this government's authoritarian practices. The Committee to Protect Journalists said in a statement, we urge Ecuadorian authorities to immediately withdraw this politically motivated procedure and allow Fundamedios to continue its work without any government interference. An active civil society and tolerance of dissenting views are vital components of any democracy. The U.S. shares international concern over the Ecuadorian government's efforts to silence critical voices and deny its citizens access to a diversity of information and ideas. The U.S. calls on the government of Ecuador to honor its commitments under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the American Convention on Human Rights by upholding freedom of expression and association as fundamental democratic rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.